I'm Observer Editor Arnold Hamilton.
And I'm Marianne Martin.
And this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy, powered by the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation.
This week, as the coronavirus tightens its grip on Oklahoma and the nation, we explore the chaos it has created when attempting to access essential state services.
Since becoming governor 15-plus months ago, former mortgage company CEO Kevin Stitt repeatedly has pledged to make Oklahoma a top 10 state and emphasized the need to run state government like a business in order to better serve its customers.
The rhetoric, though, has not matched the reality. There is no better example than the state's unemployment services, which began showing signs earlier this year that it wouldn't be up to the challenge of a pandemic. Even before COVID-19 spurred an extraordinary 67,000 unemployment claims in the last 2 weeks, the system was already scrambling to process claims related to the loss of an estimated 11,000 oil field-related jobs between January 1st and March 15th.
How could this be? Shouldn't an oil and gas dependent state like Oklahoma be especially well positioned to meet the challenges of routine, periodic volatility in the carbon markets? This is not our first rodeo when it comes to oil prices plummeting seemingly overnight.
The reality is, state government's infrastructure of vital services like unemployment have been forced for nearly a decade to make do with starvation budgets enacted by the Republican-dominated legislature. Leaner staffs, juggling more cases, often producing less satisfactory responses through no fault of their own.
The unemployment system's meltdown in the wake of the coronavirus was all too predictable. Uber-conservative statehouse Republicans have been devoted to Ronald Reagan's infamous line, the most dangerous 9 words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." They were ideologically wired to believe smaller, leaner government would automatically, magically, yield better results.
The fact is, you get what you pay for. And when state lawmakers starting in 2011 really tightened the screws on state budgets, they hollowed out an infrastructure to the point where state government was ill-equipped to respond to a calamity like COVID-19.
It is true that state unemployment offices across the nation are struggling to process the historic number of coronavirus-related job loss claims, 6.6 million last week alone. But the loss of so many oil field-related jobs in the first 3 months of the year should have sounded the alarm for state house policymakers, including Governor Stitt, that rough seas could be ahead if the virus gripped America like it did China and Italy.
Norman resident Christina Owen and her family are experiencing this government failure firsthand. And State Representative Forrest Bennett is hearing from anguished and angered constituents whose state government is letting them down in their hour of need. They are our guests this week on ObserverCast.
My name is Christina Owen, and I do a lot of activism and advocacy, but that's all in my spare time. That's not something that I get paid to do or anything like that. Currently, I am a student. I recently went back to school, and I'm also self-employed, though right now it's been more part-time while I've been going to school full-time. Also a mother of 2, one just turned 1, so technically 2 toddlers. So I've got a lot of spinning plates in the air right now.
Yes, I would concur. how's the semester going? Are you at OU or are you at a different school?
Right now, I'm taking a couple of classes over at OCCC because they're cheaper than OU.
Right.
And at this point, I'm kind of debating what's the next plan because my original plan before all this was to just be at OU full-time for the summer semester. Now we've had things change with COVID-19. One of the classes that I was taking, they tried to transfer to be online only, and it does not transfer well. So they had to cancel that class. So I'm having to look at potentially taking that class again next fall at OCCC and probably being a concurrent student at both OU and OCCC. So there's definitely been some changes, and I'm going to have to think what's the next process for my next semester with all the changes that we've experienced.
So can you talk, you know, in the best of situations, what it's like for you to balance? Because I know you have a partner at home. You know, what it's like to balance being a student, working, being a mother, just kind of how that works normally under the best of circumstances, per se.
Well, the best of circumstances, it's still very tight. You know, with having the decision to go back to school, all of those were things that we had to discuss, have a very tight budget. We already have to, you know, really watch our bills. We don't have wiggle room, even in the best of scenarios. I have to do our budget every single paycheck. So every 2 weeks I have to sit down and divide our bills out by paycheck to be able to pay them and make sure that everything is running smoothly. And even then, we also have help from family. You know, my mom is a great help. She buys diapers and wipes, formula, things like that that we need for the kids. So already in the best of situations, it was very tight, but we had a good support system. Things were trekking, but there definitely wasn't any wiggle room before that. And leading up to me deciding to go back to school, just to kind of give some background information, my first pregnancy was in 2017. It was a high-risk pregnancy. I ended up being bedridden for several months. Then when my oldest was 3 months old, I ended up having a major injury where I ended up being bedridden again for several months and had to relearn how to walk. And then just when I started walking again, surprise, surprise, birth control pregnancy, baby number two. So I had ended up spending a lot of time being temporarily disabled, being bedridden, not being able to work a typical 9-to-5 job. Even when I did apply for jobs, when I was using a walker, I saw a lot of people that just weren't interested because they didn't feel like, you know, my mobility was going to be a good fit for them, which you would think that that wouldn't be allowed, but sadly it is. So I had already run into situations where I kept being stuck at home and not being able to work regularly. So I started working more for myself, being self-employed, doing things that I could do at home on the computer. So that's what led me to deciding to go back to school, because I had already been in a place where I hadn't been able to work. So I figured with this time, it'd be the perfect time to go back to school. So that's some background information about our family as well, and kind of how we got to this point before COVID-19 even happened.
So complicated in the best of situations.
Right.
Now, what has happened in the past couple of weeks to kind of, because you've had a number of things surrounding COVID, correct?
Yeah, it's been very trying. So first of all, to be able to go back to school, I ended up putting both of our girls into early Head Start. Before that, they had been with me 24/7, being stay-at-home mom while working from my computer at home. So this semester was their first time going into early Head Start, and that was the way that I was able to go back to school and have that breathing room to get more things done. So obviously, as with everybody else in this situation, you know, as Norman Public Schools have closed, early Head Start has closed as well. So now I have the girls home. So of course, that right there adds that stay-at-home mom job on top of trying to do school and some of the self-employment contracts that I'm still doing. So that was probably the first major aspect for COVID-19, was having the girls back home. And there's other aspects that you don't necessarily consider at first. You think it's just the fact that they're home, but you also have to consider that when they're at early Head Start, they're being fed there. They have diapers and wipes there. So suddenly now we have more expenses. Things that we didn't have to pay for before are now coming out of our pocket. Also, right before COVID-19 really became an issue here in Oklahoma, obviously it was still going on around the country, but this was before we started seeing closings and executive orders and things of that nature. But right before that, horrible timing, Dan, my partner, he was downsized from his job. So we were already in a situation where he was applying for unemployment. received a 2-week severance and was already looking and doing interviews. So we were really hopeful that he works in IT, that he would be able to find something pretty quickly. Seemed like there was a lot of interactions with interviews. So we were hoping that we wouldn't be in a bad situation for very long. Then, of course, COVID-19 happens more locally. Places start shutting down. Everybody's now, you know, filing for unemployment. Dan had already received verification that he had been approved, said we were good. So he was already doing the weekly check-ins with saying how many places he'd applied for, what have you. And we just never received our card in the mail. So we're approved for this money for unemployment benefits. And we're just sitting and we're waiting and we're not seeing it. The severance money is now gone, being only 2 weeks. And bills are coming up. So, you know, what are you supposed to do? And at this point, you know, Dan's called several times, been on hold several hours. You can't reach anybody. There's just no way. You try every extension number. You hit every button that transfers you to a different department to see if you can reach a live person to maybe get you to the right person. And nothing. And he can see when he looks online this card that's somewhere that is accruing week after week. We see we are receiving unemployment benefits on a card that we don't have. So now we get to a point that we have 4 weeks of unemployment sitting on some mystery card that's somewhere. I'm assuming at this point that it's been lost in the mail. Something has happened, but we can't find someone to talk to. We have fallen through the cracks and there is not a button to push on an automated system that says, you know, we haven't received our card or anything like that. Some people had offered that we could sign up for direct deposit. So you go online, you try that option. Well, you need your card number, which obviously we don't have. The other option is to put in your social security number. Okay, great. He does that. They can't find him in the system. Okay, cool. So now we've fallen through two different cracks that have now made it impossible to navigate the system. We've been approved. There is money out there. There is no way for us to receive that money. There is no way for us to access that money. So in the meantime, I had also applied for SNAP benefits to see if we would qualify with Dan with unemployment. So I also, now at this point when I applied for the SNAP, this was after the fact of places closing down. So it was not at the same time as the unemployment. It was probably a couple weeks after that. So we were approved, and for a family of four and with Dan receiving unemployment, we were going to get, I believe it was $83 a month, SNAP benefits, but you know, every little bit helps. So I had applied, and when you do it, it applied for SNAP and TANF because I wasn't 100% sure what that covered. So we were denied for TANF and we were approved for the SNAP benefits. So I'm waiting on that information in the mail. I receive a card in the mail, which honestly I thought was junk mail. I thought it was like a credit card offer or something. I was like, I have no idea what this is. It didn't come with any additional information. It wasn't until like looking at the card that I was like, well, it says Oklahoma on it. That doesn't look like a normal credit card. And I'm reading through all the fine print and it says that this is the card that the state will put money on. So I thought, oh, I guess this is my SNAP card. I thought there'd be more information, you know, like what you can buy, what you can't buy from the store, what have you. So they have an app you can download. They have a website. They have a phone number. I go on there and this card only shows TANF $0 because I did not get approved for TANF. No SNAP benefits on there. So I'm thinking I received a TANF card, but not a SNAP card maybe. So, you know, I went to the website, I went to the app, I called the phone numbers and I cannot get any help on that whatsoever. Even when I did get somebody who was on, the third party contract for distributing the cards, they said on their end, it just showed that, I hadn't received the card yet, that they couldn't issue a new card. They just told me to wait. because my benefits were going to start April 1st and it was still the end of March. So they said, just wait, maybe you'll get something else in the mail, which I did. And I have received nothing additional in the mail. So it's April 3rd, a couple of days ago, just out of frustration, you know, knowing that we have been approved for SNAP benefits, we have been approved and are accruing unemployment benefits, neither of which we have any way of accessing. I wrote a post on Facebook just with my frustration saying, you know, we went through the hoops, we did all the things, and apparently we have fallen through these cracks. I guess we're just very unlucky. I don't know how in the world this can happen on both Dan's end and on my end. And now it's the beginning of the month. We have bills to pay. You know, we're running out of staple things. You know, we're running out of milk. We're running out of bread. You know, what can we do? So here we had spent days and hours on hold. We've sent emails where we could. I know Dan never got a response on the email he sent. The email I sent was to the individual person that did my interview for SNAP benefits. And apparently she's on vacation for 2 weeks. So I got an automated, you know, I'll be out of town, but you can contact my boss with her boss's name, but no phone number or email for her boss. So doesn't really leave me any option going further on that. So somehow, I guess through luck on Facebook, you know, I know a lot of people and some other people tagged friends that they know that worked with the Oklahoma Unemployment Commission. And we had someone reach out to us and I was able to talk with them on Messenger on Facebook. And they said they looked it up. They found Dan's information and they said, yeah, we see that there's money on the card. Apparently the card is sitting at our third party, you know, location. They never mailed it. So it fell through the cracks on the part of the card company that distributes those. So it's like, okay, great. Can they resend it? You know, what can we do to get this card? And, I was told that they could have the card expedited to us so that we could get it, hopefully within 24, 48 hours. I said, yes, let's do that. Great. It's going to be a $15 fee. Okay. I'm assuming they're just going to pull the $15 from the money on the card. I thought just do what you can just to get the money here. We've got bills to pay and maybe I can fight the $15 fee later. Cause why am I paying $15 to expedite a card that should have been here a month ago? So at this point, we still have not received the card. Dan did receive a notification that it was mailed and received a notification that it would arrive from UPS delivering it. So we're hopeful. We thought maybe it would be yesterday. Didn't happen yesterday. We're hopeful that maybe it will be today. So at least the unemployment part seems to be moving. And then on SNAP, one of my friends on Facebook, I didn't realize, is now working with the Oklahoma DHS department through a contract with OU. And she was able to reach out to her boss with my case number to say, you know, can you look into this? Can you get back with her? And I guess her boss then sent an email to someone who's assigned to my case. Now, for all I know, that might be the person I emailed initially that's on vacation for 2 weeks. But I was told that if I didn't receive anything in the mail or receive a phone call by Monday, to let my friend know, and she would reach out to her boss again. So at least I feel like there's some movement. But remember, this is through a Facebook post. This isn't through calling the numbers or going online or doing the apps or doing any of the things that we're told to do to reach out for benefits. When it came to that, it was a big wall. You know, there was nowhere that we could go. There was no other number that we could call. It was a complete blockout. That what are you going to do besides sit here and think, you know, hopefully someone responds to an email at some point. There was literally no option for us at that point. We had tried everything and still didn't have any information. So a Facebook post did more in less than an hour than days on websites and phone calls and sitting for hours on hold. So that's kind of been our story so far in trying to receive the benefits that we'd already been approved for.
Well, and you have a sizable network too. And so, yes. You know, I mean, and that was kind of the key to all of it, was you were able to get anything done because you were able to leverage your personal network, which
exactly.
is great. And
what do you do if you're somebody who doesn't have friends who have connections exactly. like you do, or, you know, worse, even internet connection and ability to, you know, you can't even go to the library these days and get online to do things.
Right.
Well, and you were applying like for benefits outside of the COVID situation, like everything you were trying to do started before any of this happened. And then it just kind of coalesces, you know, aligns with this crisis, I'll just tell you, like, this morning we were, my husband's like finding all of our tax documents, and I was on unemployment in the fall, and he was like, I need your 1099-G or whatever for that. And I was like, I know I have it. And I was like, I hope I don't have to ask for a copy, because I know I'm not going to get through to anybody right now. So, right. I mean, it's kind of a mess. So what would you say are some key takeaways from this situation, Christina? Like, what do you think could be done better for this, through this?
I hope that our state has realized that we have an infrastructure problem, that we are not in any way prepared for an event that they're receiving 20,000 phone calls a day. Obviously, this is an unprecedented situation for Oklahoma and for the nation, but we see that we don't have a means of getting through to people. I don't know if they're short-staffed. I don't know if they're limited in the amount of available phone lines or the availability of people to work at home. I know everyone that I had spoken to on the SNAP side of things when I did my interview to be approved, she was working remotely at home. So I don't know if they just need to hire more people in this situation, or if it's a technological infrastructure issue. Thankfully, on the financial aspect, you know, we've seen the packages that are being approved on the federal level for money to come to the state to pay, to be able to give more benefits to people. Because without that, I really don't know what Oklahoma would do. It would feel like probably a Black Friday, where instead of fighting for a TV, you're fighting for unemployment benefits. So at least we have federal aid to help the state, because Oklahoma has been struggling for so long. We don't have extra money. We don't have money to pay for things like this.
And there has been no investment, meaningful investment in infrastructure, any sort of infrastructure for, you know, decades probably. So, you know, having been a state employee, just the disconnect between the needs, the IT needs of the state, and what they're actually willing to deliver is stunning.
And hey, absolutely. there's plenty of IT people. I know one that that could definitely help out with some ideas or some planning and things, because I've heard people say, you know, why is the system set up for me to call 20 times a day and then just hang up on me, or say, we're not accepting phone calls at this time, that you have to keep calling until you can get into a queue? Why can't we have it set up where every call is at least accepted and told, you know, you are number 117th in line, and we will call you back, you know, whenever it's your time. You know, there's other systems that are able to do that. So I understand it's really hard to just make a switch in infrastructure. You can't do that overnight, but we should at least be working towards that. And it should definitely be the plan going forward, that we should have a program implemented to at least accept every phone call and tell them, you know, hey, it's Tuesday at 1:15. At this point, we estimate calling you back Thursday at 3 p.m. Even though that seems like a ridiculous amount of time, I would much rather hear that than this roulette game of just let's keep calling, and we'll play, will I be hung up on? Will I wait for 2 hours and then be hung up on? Or will someone answer the phone? And that's what we're doing.
And I'll tell you too, like, Dan, I don't know how much experience or either of you have with filing unemployment, but I'd say one out of every 4 weeks at least, if not more. I'd be rocking along on the check-in, you know, checking all the answers. I'd get to the very end to submit. And then the next screen that would pop up was like, we are experiencing problems at this time. Mm-hmm. Please check back. And then it wouldn't say if you were approved, because sometimes it actually would have gone through and sometimes it didn't. And so you would have to, like, you would just have to wait to see if there was a deposit in your card,
right?
To know if it went through. And so, yeah, I mean, the system is so weak. It's so weak. And so, I don't know how to fix it. I just know that it's really, really, it's dated. Mm-hmm. Oh boy. So yeah, but when it directly impacts families like yours, right. You know, you're trying to do the right thing. You're trying to take care of your family.
When I was single, because the only time I've had direct experience with unemployment myself was in 2009, you know, economy crashed. At the time I was doing corporate events. Obviously nobody was paying tens of thousands of dollars for company picnics when the economy was crashing. So I was on unemployment at that time. So that was 2009. That was more than 10 years ago. The system mm-hmm. has not changed since then. There has not been any updates to the website. There's been no updates to the system. And back then, you know, I was single. It was just me. So, you know, if I had to worry about, you know, not being able to pay rent or something, I could always, you know, go back to mom's house or something like that. You know, if I was just eating a crappy diet, you know, so be it. I could get by on that. But now we're a family of four. I have a 2.5-year-old and a 1-year-old. I can't just be like, well, we don't have milk. Let's just give them soda. You know, I can't switch those things out. And it's not so easy if we ended up in a situation homeless to find a home for four people. So there's definitely a larger sense of dread and concern and anxiety that a lot of these things that I might have been able to weather better as a single individual adult 10 years ago, I'm in a very different situation now.
So I'm curious how you have coped with what must be an incredible feeling of helplessness at this time.
I do have to say that, you know, just like I'm sure nearly everybody is right now, we all have stress. We all have anxiety. Dan and I, we have conversations daily and kind of check in. We kind of try to come up with ideas, things we can do, kind of checklists. Okay, you call this number and try this thing today. I'm going to follow up on this email or what have you. And stress is high. And sometimes we find that, you know, we're snapping at each other or we're less patient with each other. And we try to realize that, you know, hey, we're just stressed. Let's just take a minute. I know that, you know, I've been apparently incessantly biting the inside of my bottom lip to the point that I don't notice and it just starts hurting. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like I've totally like torn up my inner lip and not even thought about it consciously. It's just like this subconscious, anxious, you know, action that I'm taking. But at this point, I'm not as bad because I feel like, you know, things are at least in motion. Wheels are in motion. There are a lot of resources out there. They may be temporary. They may be one time, but we're trying to do what we can. Norman Public Schools offering the food for, you know, any children under 18. At first, I didn't think if that would apply for me because the girls are so young, but we went, we said we had two kids and boom, we have 5 bags of groceries. That's enough for breakfasts and lunch for both of them for 5 days. So now I've kind of set up a schedule in my phone where I know, you know, hey, Mondays, go to Norman Public Schools to get food for the girls. We have WIC. So I know my WIC starts April 4th. So April 4th, I can go to the store for very specific things, because for people that aren't aware, WIC is different than SNAP. SNAP is money that you can spend on groceries. WIC, it's very specific. Like you can get 3 gallons of non-fat milk. You can get 2 pounds of cheese, and it has to be the brands that have the WIC symbol on them. So I know, okay, April 4th, I can get some food here. I found out my school, OCCC, has a food bank that you can apply online and you fill out a form and you kind of request things. I haven't done this before. Today, I'm actually going to pick it up this afternoon, and they have a disclaimer on there, you know, that what you ask for may not be in stock. So I don't know if I'm going to get all the things I asked for, or half, or two items. I have no clue. So at this point, you know, we're kind of playing this game of like, you know, what's available? What can we do? As long as there's food on the table, bills right now are just on hold. You know, I've heard that we're not evicting people. I've heard we're not turning off, you know, electric and water at this time. I really hope there's not going to be late fees on top of everything, because like I said in the beginning, in the best of situations,
so much worse.
Yeah. Oh my, exactly. In the best of situations, things are tight. If we're going to start having late fees on top, I don't know if we're ever going to catch up. So I have this kind of crazy schedule right now where it's like, okay, you know, these are the places that I can pick up food for the kids. These are places that I might be able to pick up some food for us. At OCCC, I don't know if that's one time only, once a semester, once a month. I'll have to figure that out today. We see different places offering box lunches. So when I'm done here, Dan's going to leave to go to a local business that's handing out box lunches to hopefully grab some for us today. And the other aspect of that is not only trying to make sure that we have food and that we're taken care of, but also every time we leave the house to do these things is potentially a point of contact to get sick. So you can't win. There's always a negative aspect. It's like, yay, we have more food. We don't have to worry about that. Maybe we just got coronavirus. So you just have to be so careful and so safe. And as it is, whenever I go out for groceries, which at this point, in the beginning was probably once a week. Now it's more like once every 2 weeks, especially now that I'm waiting for money to come in to be able to do it. I not only get food for my family, I get groceries for my grandma. I get groceries for my mom. So I'm doing pharmacy and grocery runs for extended family. So at the end of the day, I'm one person doing the errands that are needed for about 8 people. So that I'm trying to at least lessen the impact of going out. And since I feel like I'm the least at risk if I did get COVID-19. So on top of just the struggling and the finances and the food, now there's this whole other layer of, you know, the actual virus itself and trying to make sure that we're not getting sick, that we're not passing it on.
Well, Arnold, I don't have anything else. Do you?
No, I'm just sitting here in stunned silence listening to this and thinking that you're, in a sense, you know, a poster family for all the folks out there who don't think that government provides useful services and that sort of thing and have worked to underfund government services over the last several decades. Now all of a sudden, the reality is coming home, I think, for a lot of people in this state and in country, actually. And you guys provide a vivid illustration of what it's like to be doing all the right things to keep moving forward, and yet you keep running into brick walls. And I'd be paralyzed. I'd be doing more probably than biting my lip.
Well, and I mean, it's already a stressful time. So to also constantly just get, you know, a brick wall, a no, a non-answer, a hang up, it's demoralizing on top of a very stressful situation. So I'm sure that there's just a lot of families that are in the same situation as us, and a lot of families in worse situations. Like I said, we were lucky. My Facebook post actually got something accomplished. What about for the people that don't have that? So it's very hard to try to navigate things right now. Even if there are resources out there, you might not know about them, especially if you don't have internet access, if you don't have Facebook. I mean, my grandma, she doesn't have a Facebook account. She doesn't have a smartphone. If she was in this situation and she didn't have anybody, I don't know what she would do.
Okay. So speaking of internet access, I think internet is precarious for everybody right now.
Yeah.
Well, Christina, thank you so much for your time. This will come out on a Monday. I'll message you and let you know when it's going. We're going to talk to Forrest Bennett later today.
I know a lot of state legislators are hearing from constituents like you saying this is a nightmare right now, and so it's going to be interesting to see if and when the state is able to get its act together on all this.
Right. Sure seems like a rainy day in Oklahoma.
In more ways than one.
Last time I checked, my name is Forrest Bennett, and I am a state representative for House District 92, which covers Midtown, Downtown, Southside, Oklahoma City.
All right. Well, thanks for being with us today. So we all know what's going on with the coronavirus. Arnold and I, well, I'll just tell you. So perhaps you share my frustration with the governor's response to the virus. But the other day, a friend on Facebook, and we interviewed her earlier, she has two small children and a partner who is out of work, and they have just had the worst time filing for unemployment benefits, SNAP, and TANF. And so I just think the entirety of the governor's response has been troubling. So we wanted to talk to you about what you get your thoughts on what's been happening.
Yeah, I to put it very lightly, I share your frustration with the governor's response. And you know, we've tried from the beginning to sort of try to keep our criticisms as sort of direct and private as possible, so as not to increase any type of anxiety that people are already feeling by making public sort of, I don't want to say derogatory, but you know, constructive criticism. But it's getting past that point, because it's very obvious, you know, the governor only took statewide action after so many people you know, pressured him to do so. I had heard that early on he wasn't personally very worried about this, but he felt political pressure to do something. And you know, you hear those things, and they appear to be backed up by what's going on. And it really, if I sit here and think about it long enough, get really, really upset about it. But luckily, I know there are a lot of sort of mid-level managers across agencies that are involved in this that are doing the best they can to make responses fast and get resources to people. And of course, across the state and across the country and around the world, you're seeing sort of people pick up the slack where government inaction could otherwise hurt and try to help people out. But I don't know. It is the line from the governor's office that we should rely on everybody's, you know, personal responsibility is very frustrating, because it seems to me that the vast majority of us are doing that. But you can count the governor's office among those who are not taking personal responsibility, and that's frustrating.
Well, then even the statewide measure is really only a half measure, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, I did applaud the governor when he did something, because it was better than nothing. But this piecemeal sort of, you know, it's very reactive, you know, and we know, you know, this is a modern society. People move between counties. People move between communities. And if in your county it's not being taken seriously, you know, I'm sure you've seen the posts that I've seen from sheriffs across the state, you know, in rural areas specifically, who say, you know, I don't believe this coronavirus stuff is that serious. And then you see others that, you know, get it and say, please, everyone, stay home. But But what would really aid those of us who understand why we need to take this seriously would be a statewide blanket measure. The idea that we could do this for only counties that are affected totally misses the point of prevention. And I would say, you know, due to the poor leadership of the president and so many governors who are taking his sort of taking cues from him, we are playing mitigation much more than prevention. And we could have been playing a prevention game here, but at this point, really, obviously, we're mitigating, and there are much more effective ways to mitigate than what the governor's doing now.
Well, I'm going to mix some metaphors here, but it appears to me that the chickens are coming home to roost with this pandemic here in Oklahoma specifically, since that's where we are. From the years of the hollowing out of state government and state services, the starvation budget diets and that sort of thing, we don't really seem to be very well positioned to suddenly meet the demands of a pandemic like this that was wholly predictable. It was not a question of if, it was a question of when.
Yes. There are two interesting. I don't know how to. It's not funny because we're in it now, but it's amusing to a degree, and it's frustrating to a larger degree. Two things. One, specifically in rural Oklahoma, the absolute decimation of healthcare access to quality and affordable healthcare in rural communities has gone down. We have literal shuttered hospitals and clinics out there that could right now be serving as the first line of defense against this virus for people who otherwise wouldn't have access to help. We have hospitals that are shuttered because of our, I mean, as a direct result of our inaction over the last decade. And to see so clearly, I mean, with the representation of these large shuttered buildings, that we could have been in a better position had we just done the kind of investing that you see reasonable state governments across the country doing, we could have been in a much better position. And then the other thing is this consolidation of power that the Republican legislature sort of just rolled over and let the governor do after he got elected, where you know, everything passes through him, and we have we have very little transparent access to executive branch agencies, unless we get that access through the governor's office. These things are making it more difficult, specifically because of who is in charge. And I think two things we can learn immediately. And one is that we should take this as a lesson to not decimate core public government services like healthcare. And then we really need to think twice before putting somebody in a position when they have no experience in that. So I know that I've taken some, I know I've upset some people by pointing out that I think it's a bad idea to have people heading agencies and heading the executive branch of government that do not have any government experience or relative experience in their, in whatever agency they're heading. The health department is one example of that. And we find ourselves at the most critical moment, and at the most critical moment, we have people who are novices in these areas, and it shows.
So, I mean, Arnold and I were talking about this earlier. Like, we have a secretary of health and mental health with zero background in any of that. We have a health commissioner who has not directly done anything in terms of public health before. And then, you know, Dr. Schrum is on stage. And just like, what? I'm just kind of at a loss for the unwillingness to bring forth the expertise that we have in this state, because I get the sense that people are really scared to speak out.
Yes.
I don't know. Am I wrong?
No, I think, I mean, based on the conversations that I had with people prior to this, who were experiencing the change in culture after the consolidation of power happened, I'm talking about the same people who were legislative liaisons before, or people who worked for agencies, and you've had this experience, Marianne, who used to be able to speak freely, who used to be, I mean, imagine if we still had a world where, Joe Albaugh was in charge of corrections, or Terry White was in charge of Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services. These were people who were leading from their positions. They were we had a discussion about mental health funding and just sort of making our mental health infrastructure more robust. We had those conversations far before it was nationally popular to do so, because we had people in those positions who were willing to use their platforms to do that. Now we don't have that. We don't have, and they were able to move the needle. They were able to give coverage to Republicans who wanted to make an effort in these ways. They normalized a lot of these conversations. We don't have that anymore, because directly as a result of what we have allowed to have happen in the last couple of years. And it is showing, Arnold, to your point, I mean, really, the chickens have come home to roost on all of these areas.
I mean, so I feel like we could lay out all the ways that the disinvestment, the underfunding of state government is kind of culminating right now, right? So first, I think of Christina's family's experience trying to file for unemployment, SNAP, and TANF. So right there, I cannot see how OESC's system like does not absolutely crumble under the massive surge of people filing for unemployment right now. You have DHS workers who are responsible for vetting these applications for SNAP and TANF, and Christina can't get a hold of a human because apparently her caseworker was on vacation for 2 weeks. And I mean, the fact that someone like didn't call staff back in is interesting to me, right? And so so this is happening. But then you just think of the IT burdens on the state. Like, this is really kind of in the top of mind for me, just the fact that our entire school system in the state of Oklahoma is now having to go distance learning, so-called distance learning, in all the ways that individual districts and classrooms are having to differentiate because of the lack of a telecommunications network, and like a robust telecommunications network in the state of Oklahoma. And we have no capability to remedy any of that right now. Like, this is, am I wrong in saying, like, these are just a few of the ways that, on top of, as you pointed out, are absolutely inadequate healthcare system to respond to this. You know, I mean, just all of that together, like, we have such a weakened capability to respond and protect Oklahomans.
Yep. I mean, and it was an unforced error, and it reflects an ideology that I mean, this is the bottom line. Well, there's plenty of bottom lines, but to your point, we have for a decade and more seen the state government divest from core services. And say somehow, you know, these people will be taken care of in some other way. And you have seen the nonprofit community, the faith community, and the private sector come in to try to stand in the gap between what people need and what the state government is willing to provide. But unfortunately, we have done that so much under regular circumstances over the last decade and more that now that we are in a crisis and we need the best of all, private sector, faith, nonprofit, and government, we are already stretched so thin. I mean, you talk to nonprofit organizations, so thin, so overburdened, and faith-based organizations, private sector, all of these, you know, and we should never, ever ever be put in a position where our ability to survive a pandemic rests in the charity of the private sector, because you are at the will of individuals who, you know, are programmed to look
profit. Think about yeah. profit.
And we mm-hmm. can celebrate the people that are deciding to do kind things all we want, but we have to really step back and ask ourselves, why are we in a position where we can breathe a sigh of relief because the owner of the Patriots took his plane over to China, you know, to get supplies for Boston? That's, I mean, this is no way to try to manage a crisis. And I mean, from the top down, we have seen, we can point to specific moments and specific things that our president didn't do, that our governor didn't do, or that previous leaders did to put us in this position. That's what's so unique about this, I think. You know, it shouldn't have blindsided us, but it did. But it is so clear in retrospect, all of the things that happened to put us in a position that we are in today, where our ability to face this crisis is so diminished.
So I'm going to guess that in your position, you are hearing more frequently from constituents today than you might have a couple of months ago.
Yes.
What are you hearing most about, and what troubles you most?
I think it's the disconnect between what's being said at the top and what's actually happening on the ground. For example, you know, the governor has really been singing a tune the last couple of days about really wanting to ramp up testing, because his view is that we have the testing capacity now. But the truth is, I've been told the hospital up the street from my house has at most at any time 80 tests, and that they are still sending people home who are exhibiting all of the symptoms and just saying, hey, we're not going to test you. You probably have it. Just go home and be by yourself. Well, I mean, that flies in the face of what the governor is asking people to do. However, they also, I would assume, are in that position and doing what they're doing because they're concerned that they won't have the resources that they need when they really need it. And so everybody's kind of measuring their own capacity to test and to take care of people based on what they think is going to happen with not a lot of feedback from people above the sort of supply chain from them. That is very frustrating to me. And then, you know, outside of that, because really the most, this is what's amazing. In spite of the ineptitude of some of our institutions, our success at beating this and surviving this lays largely with individuals and what we choose to do. Are we social distancing? Are we staying home? These things can get us over the hump in spite of what's going on at the government level, but are they doing it? And you know, in one way, I have total control over what I do, but I have zero control over what other people do, and that's frustrating and a little bit scary, because you see people on social media that are just ignoring this and pretending that it's not a big deal, and part of that comes from false hope being sold by the president every time he steps up to the podium. These things worry me. I am optimistic because of how quickly I've seen, some agencies sort of change direction. You may be asking this question later, but I am fascinated at how quickly we've become this very progressive state government in light of a crisis, making sure that people can access unemployment benefits as quickly as possible, and sort of bolstering our safety net so that people can get the help they need. I mean, we're doing a lot of stuff that for a long time conservative politics doesn't sort of allow, because in the face of, you know, a crisis, it's a no-brainer.
But we may have pivoted on policy, it seems to me, Forrest, but we do not have the infrastructure in place, because people that we're hearing from indicate, you know, enormous challenges to try to access the unemployment system, for example, and SNAP benefits and different things like that. The system is overwhelmed at this time, it appears.
Yeah. And I'm hopeful that we'll have some resources from the federal government. And I know that we will be getting an influx of over $1 billion. I believe over $1 billion to the state. And a significant portion of that will be directed directly towards the healthcare system and municipalities and things like that. But the state will have the ability to use some of those resources. And I don't see a way that they can use it for any other purpose than making sure that OESC is solvent and that people are able to access the benefits that they need. That really is, I think it speaks to a larger issue. How many of our people are just one paycheck away from being in a really critical situation? How fragile is the success of this system that we have, you know? And that's obviously, I think that after this is all over, we really owe it to ourselves to sit down before we go back to normal, ask ourselves, what parts of normal do we want to go back to? And what parts of this new normal do we need to keep? What lessons do we learn? And what are we going to do now in this moment to make sure that it doesn't happen again? And a lot of that has to do with taking care of workers. And you have all of these workers that are keeping the country going that for a long time have just been sort of sidelined by white collar America. You know, your fast food workers, delivery drivers, these people who are literally keeping us going. So I'm looking ahead to that and really trying to make sure that I catalog what lessons we're learning now. I know.
So what? Yeah. So what advice? What advice do you have for people like Christina, who we interviewed earlier, who are in that paycheck away from disaster and are having trouble getting the benefits that they've been approved for already? In the meantime, the bills continue to come due, and there still needs to be milk in the refrigerator and bread on the table.
Yeah, I think anybody who's lived paycheck to paycheck knows the drill here. I was like driving for Postmates the day I got elected to the legislature back in 2016. That was my main source of income at that time, because I wasn't teaching anymore, and I there was nobody that wanted to hire somebody that may be leaving for 4 months out of the year if they got elected. So I was living paycheck to paycheck. I remember walking into my apartment and my wife now can tell you when we were dating one time, very embarrassed, walked into my apartment and my electricity had been shut off because I had to pick and choose what bills I was able to pay. In this situation, this is just, I hate to give this advice, but people who've been in that position know you do what is the top priority for you and your family. And when you really get down to it, when you're facing that, you know which bills need to be paid and what can wait. And then, just hoping for the charity of the people to whom you may be indebted. And that's, am I happy to be saying any of this? Absolutely not. But we are in a unique situation where around the world, everyone understands the situation. And I wish that we had the kind of compassion that I'm seeing today all the time. But I am hopeful that sheer compassion will get some people through this. But I absolutely believe that local, state, and the federal government have an obligation to people who will be economically destroyed by this. They should not be. And we should be doing everything that we can to ensure that they don't. The federal government is taking strides in that direction. I believe that we still need to do more. I see that Oklahoma City and Tulsa, for example, are providing small business loans and things like that. And some of these, some of the strings attached are like, you've got to keep the people that you employ on your payroll and make sure that they're still getting paid and all those requirements, I think, are really important. But all of that's to say, this situation is moving very fast, and I'm seeing a lot of businesses and individuals sort of recalibrating how they operate in order to be as compassionate and helpful as possible. And I hope to see more and more people do that.
Thank you, Representative Bennett, for talking with us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I wish that it was
under better circumstances. Subject,
but I do. I'm not trying to sort of spread false hope, but I do believe that we will get through this, and I do believe that that we will see some large structural changes to the way we do things as a result of it. My computer just went dead, so I'm wondering if you guys.
Yep, we can hear you.
Great. that was a bad omen, maybe. I will say that on the whole, I am seeing much more from humanity that gives me hope than I am seeing that causes me despair. And unfortunately, the despair comes largely from the institutions that we're supposed to rely on. But I am seeing a lot of good in this world, and I think that that will only continue. And I know that we'll be better off when we get to the other side of this.
Nationwide, we have seen sharp differences in the way red states and blue states have handled the pandemic. Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York has become something of a superstar through his dry, matter-of-fact, regular press conference updates as COVID-19 ravages his state. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer is the latest female politician to garner a derogatory nickname from the president due to her steadfast defense of the needs of her state. And Governor Gavin Newsom in California is developing a national consortium for the protective equipment and medical machinery needed to keep people alive because the national strategic stockpile has failed to deliver. One story tells how when California received 170 ventilators from the national reserves, they were broken. So Newsom contacted a company in California who fixed them and deployed them to hospitals around the state. Now the news reports that California is sending 500 ventilators back to the national stockpile for use in New York.
A few other stories from around the U.S. have stood out as the pandemic unfolds. For me, it was how Illinois developed an emergency rapid procurement team for the equipment the federal government did not or would not deliver to the state. The state comptroller raced down the interstate with a $3 million check from the state to meet a contact at a McDonald's who could purchase and deliver over 1 million N95 masks from China that had to deposit the check by 2 p.m. The contact got the check to the bank with 20 minutes to spare to wire funds to China.
Then there's Florida, whose current governor, Ron DeSantis, has refused to close the beaches during spring break as the rest of the country began to shutter. One story from the Tampa Bay Times relays how Florida bulked up its pandemic response and state public health agency in the early 2000s after repeated warnings and reports from state epidemiologists to prepare for a pandemic similar to the one we're seeing right now. Then Republican Rick Scott took office as governor, and he dismantled Florida's public health, leading to the mishandling of an outbreak of tuberculosis and then a hepatitis A outbreak.
A story published by ProPublica on April 3rd is a good reminder that public health and human services are often the locus of partisan budget knife fights. And now we're seeing the ramifications play out with the shortcomings of the strategic national stockpile. ProPublica tells us how the Tea Party rise to power in Congress over anger at the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010 led to budget standoffs between Republicans and Democrats, and then to sequestration with automatic budget cuts to sectors of the federal budget that Republicans typically protect, namely defense. The Obama administration had managed to build up the national stockpile during the 2009 H1N1 flu outbreak, but the budget fights led to its neglect in subsequent years. And now, in the fourth year of the Trump administration, we're reading multiple news reports of multiple warnings about impending threats of a global pandemic and the need for robust planning that went unheeded by the Trump administration that distributes a stockpile on a partisan basis, leaving blue states to hand-deliver state checks to middlemen just to procure desperately needed medical supplies.
We're in a red state in Oklahoma, obviously, and we would think that that would mean we'd benefit from the president's largesse in the delivery of COVID-19 tests, N95 masks, and ventilators as the state braces for our peak virus infection. But that's not what happened. Instead, we have a governor that changes his messaging on pandemic preparedness almost daily, telling Oklahomans they can all get tested, but then we read news reports that there aren't enough tests to go around. And as the economic fallout continues here in Oklahoma, from plummeting oil and gas prices to skyrocketing unemployment claims and a system that cannot process them all in a timely manner, to a stumbling, inconsistent state public health response, we at ObserverCast can't help but reflect on Nolan Clay's story in The Oklahoman about Oklahoma Commissioner of Health Gary Cox's refusal last fall to use the modest Ford Police Intercept to conduct business, instead purchasing a new Ford Explorer for nearly $30,000, and then almost $8,000 in new chairs for his conference room. The governor's Secretary of Health and Mental Health signed off on the purchase. And then, later in the fall, Commissioner Cox stunned state legislators when he submitted a budget request for fewer appropriations in the coming fiscal year. We want to thank Christina Owen and Representative Forrest Bennett for visiting with us this week. And thank you, our listeners, for joining us as we work to create a better, more informed Oklahoma.
Remember, you can download next week's ObserverCast Monday evening, April 13th. We'll be joined by State Superintendent Joy Hoffmeister for a conversation about all things public education, including the challenges of educating Oklahoma children during a pandemic, the state of public school funding, and the struggle to recruit the best qualified teachers to Oklahoma classrooms.
In the meantime, if you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give me, Arnold Hamilton, a call at 405-478-8700 or drop me an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You also can support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation. To help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage.
We also encourage you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in our 52nd year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a digital subscription special for ObserverCast listeners, just $1.99 a month for the first year, 50% off the usual monthly rate for digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, the music you're listening to is once again by Norman's Jared Deck. Go to jareddeckmusic.com for more information.